and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we simplify the good life. My name is Brock Dettis.
And I'm Aaron Flores, panicking because I realize I don't have the show notes and I don't know where my machine is. Broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global conversation, and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycling, trains, transit, and simpler living. And today, green stories?
Yes. Aaron's square.
Oh, just green stories. Aaron cubed.
Cubed.
Aaron cubed.
Oh, you're right.
Aaron cubed.
That's right. Because we are here with Aaron Flores, as usual. Aaron M. Green, author of We Were Like Sons, the upcoming project, which we'll speak about in just a moment. Hello.
Hello.
All right. We got your voice so people know what you sound like.
That's me.
And Aaron Delaney.
Hello.
Who,
ladies.
That's right. I'm trying to remember. There are a lot of men in this room, right? This is like possibly the whitest male show we've done in a while.
You maybe. Shut your mouth.
Maybe.
Whitest male.
It's the most male show we've done in a long time.
Why are there two brown people on one side of the room?
Yeah, hold on a second.
Yes, wait, did you say widest or whitest?
Oh, I was talking about the girth area.
Widest.
I thought he said widest.
That's why. That's why I like took offense all of a sudden.
I think that's called me covering for a thing that I said, and then I realized. Oh, goodness. Goodness me. Yes, and Aaron Delaney is, you have the distinction, sir, of being a guest host before you've been a guest on the show. So you come in with the upper hand, I think.
Or the lower hand.
Or something.
Yeah.
It's
or
good.
The inside baseball.
It's good to have you both here, so thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to be back, I think.
I'm trying to remember if, I guess there's been a couple guest hosts that were also guests.
I'm going to leave that up to our listeners to tell us
there
who that
go.
Was, because I don't remember and I don't care to look it up. But I know someone knows. So what happened between yesterday when we talked to the Zavikovskys and now? You spent all day in the studio cleaning it up.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful. Thank you.
I've been trapped in here. Not really trapped.
Well, it was of your own volition.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. We'll call it a retreat. I had a retreat.
There we go.
In the studio.
All right. I mean, it looks lovely. All the cables have been restrung.
I restrung and hid some of the cables.
You did hide cable. Like, there are fewer cables to be seen, and yep. I don't know where they are. I don't know where they went.
They're in the walls.
Okay. But you made it look wonderful, so thank you. And we also have a swag wall that we just started.
Yes, and now I've started a swag. Well, it's the inside of our door, but I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it'll carry over.
Right. Eventually, it's just going to be nothing but letters from listeners, and it will reflect all the sound right back into our microphones. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, we were discussing like how paper possibly reflects sound.
Right,
and,
right.
And what that might do for us.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's probably fine. I would say paper is a porous material. Not like bathroom tile. Bathroom tile is great for cutting a vocal if you're doing a record. But paper, no one ever puts you in the paper booth.
No,
get a good
that's
vocal
true.
Recording.
That's true.
So I think we're all right.
I'm going to start working on those now.
Okay. to be sold.
Yep. I'll install a paper booth for you.
Artisan paper tracking booths built right here, hand built in Portland, Oregon. Made from sustainably harvest trees.
I'm surprised how many letters we just hung on to.
We
this
do
is
have,
so
yeah.
great. All the way back from Rory.
Right. Rory sent that along with the six-pack that we have sitting here at the base of the desk, the little wooden six-pack holder.
And then just as recently as yesterday, we got the Bullet Bourbon bike thing.
Right. Oh, and the ULOC Justice Patch, which I want to mention because I don't think I put that in the notes, but we got that.
We tweeted it, though.
Yes. And that was from Chris, right?
Yes.
I believe it came in the envelope that Chris mailed us twice.
Yes.
And yes. The first
with
envelope.
With Batman Forever.
That's right, with Batman Forever stamps.
The best of the series.
Which is awesome. So thank you, Chris. And now, I guess ULOC Justice, like if you wear the patch, does that obviate, like maybe you can just flash the badge instead of actually having to perform ULOC Justice
right.
on someone's windshield?
People
with
are like,
your ULOC?
I'll back off.
Right,
now.
Exactly. Oh, I didn't realize it was one of those.
Do you know what this is, Delaney?
I do.
Oh, okay.
But that's the thing. Not everyone knows.
Oh, yeah. So what's your
take?
Well,
there's been some discussion as to, like, what exactly is ULOC justice, right?
True. I suppose many people are divided on this issue. This is contentious. There are people who take the conservative take, and there are people who take the more liberal view of ULOC justice. But for either of you, do you have an idea of what it means to you?
Well, I was just listening to one of your shows where somebody was on.
You're too kind.
Yeah, so. I really mean that.
No, he actually listens to the show more often than I do, actually.
I'm a huge fan. I have all your albums.
Well, no. All I was trying to say was.
Be careful. I might start dating you now.
And this is. Good one. No, somebody was mentioning. Being ULOC'd to a pole.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
right.
Freaking
hot, stealing
right.
a bike.
That is what...
That's the first time I had ever heard of that.
That's right.
Yeah. I guess came from the New York Messenger community.
Yeah, and somebody that we just talked to brought that up, and I don't remember who it was.
The Bike Index.
Oh, right. Yes, Mr. Hans.
Thank you.
Brian Hans. But my thought, I always thought ULOC justice meant you take your ULOC and you swing it around in your hand a couple times like a lasso, and then you let it fly. And you break somebody's windshield because they're in a lame combustion vehicle.
Cars.
That's what I thought it was, but yeah. I really don't know. Like, it could be more like the stocks where people are hung in the public square, not hung to death, but just like mounted in the public square to be the subject
However,
of ridicule.
However, someone locks you to a pole or whatever, you are there for quite a while.
Right. This is like along the lines.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Last time that happened to Mr. Delaney. Has that happened to you?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
Good. Let's not.
Let's just say no.
It's a bad idea. Yeah. So anyways, that's what we did stop by. Our friends Tammy and Logan were in town.
Just after last night.
Yeah. Of Tiny House fame. And they'll be back soon, I guess. There's some conference that they're going to be back in Portland for. But they live in California, so they're not here very often. And it was good to see them.
Yeah.
If even for just like 10 minutes
10
or something.
Minutes or yeah. so. And Tyler.
Yes, and Tyler Trigorin.
So you can say it.
I hope I said it right. Yeah, and his lovely wife, whom we have not yet met.
I mean, he's just got one of those faces. It's like, you're familiar.
Yeah, and we talked about his mustache that, you know, all of his avatars online are of him with this beautifully curled mustache, waxed and whatnot. Yeah, now he has no hair on his head at all. So, I mean, it's probably easier to keep clean and styled, I suppose.
I'd be cold.
Yeah, yeah. But then you wear hats.
I guess
but he wasn't wearing a hat.
He was not.
No.
That guy is tough.
He is, yeah. You don't want to bump into Mr. Trevorin on the streets. So, anyways, it was great to see them, and it was, yeah, it was awesome. Should I say what happened yesterday to me?
Yes.
I'm not going to elaborate.
I mean, you... Yeah, sure.
I'm just going to say that my body rebelled against me again. See our scatological emergency episode? Yesterday, I learned how to make underpants out of paper towels. And that's all I'm going to say about
that. That's all we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Or that's all we'll say about that. Yeah.
That's right. So anyways, we're on a tear of introducing uncomfortable topics. I think I'm on that tear.
You know, just let it happen, man.
Let it all hang out.
Let it all hang out. It's been working for me.
Right, right. Mr. Green, thank you for bringing the hazelnut brown nectar.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hazelnuts in Oregon, also known as filberts. Little known fact.
News to me.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that Rogue, a local brewer, still calls it a hazelnut brown nectar.
I'm sure that's because they're sending it other places.
Right. For export reasons.
Yeah, if they called it like the Filbert Firkin or whatever, like people would be like, what the fuck is that? So, yeah. So anyways, thank you for the beers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, my pleasure.
Is there anything else?
Kombucha as well.
Oh, right, right.
Brew Doctor's by far my favorite brand.
Sweet.
It's a good brew. It's made in Selwood, right?
Is it really?
I thought they had a building.
Well, no, it's made by Townsend Tea.
Okay.
So wherever Townsend, and that's local here.
Okay.
And there's a Townsend Tea House just up the road, like 28th, maybe?
Okay, yeah. There's also one in the Whole Foods in Hollywood District. That's the other place I've seen them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you're ever at Velocult and you get a hankering for some tea.
Because
Velocult, last time I checked.
Well, they do their own tea.
They do?
Yes.
They do tea now.
Velocult?
They do tea now, yes.
I was just there last night.
Okay. It was 2 years
ago.
Some
pretty interesting stuff.
Okay.
Did not get tea.
Did you get beer?
Yeah.
Good for you. That's supporting a local business. Yeah. I do love VeloCult. I was going to ask, is there anything else that you guys wanted to touch on that doesn't relate to your current projects? Anything that you have been thinking about recently? Or should we go straight to writing?
My mind is blank.
I can't think of anything.
It's all good.
It's all blank.
I mean, there's a lot of things I can touch on, but I don't want to touch a lot of things.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is true. Now, truer words never were spoken.
So, I would say that.
I was just going to say.
I learned that when I was six.
This is a funny episode.
None I know you want to touch that area, but there's a lot of anymore. Things you shouldn't touch.
Oh, man. I was going to say, Aaron Green, you go on some bicycle rides around the outskirts of town. Have you taken one recently?
Let's see. I think the most recent one I took was with Delaney.
Okay.
And that was back in October, so it's been a little while.
Ah.
But we rode up to Mount Hood.
Gotcha.
We camped. We did like a three-day thing because we had a friend having a thing in Hood River the next night. So we kind of like arced around. But we camped in this – I wish I could remember the name of that town. You're going up the
– We can't tell anyone where that was.
It's a secret camping spot.
It's a secret camping spot.
It's sort of like around government camp. But it's like right on the other side of the hill.
Okay.
It's like an old road, basically.
Yeah.
That turns into dirt after like a mile. And then it's like 10 miles of just dirt, like dirt trail type thing. And we found this old kind of camping area. And it was pretty amazing.
Was it like an abandoned campground?
It looked like it.
Or like a picnic area at least.
Or not like a picnic area. It looked like a lot of people used to camp there. But I don't know if it's ever been like an official thing.
Okay.
But it's definitely like more level in certain areas. It's more cleared.
Like this is a place where a bunch of people would drive their trucks out and like put them in a circle and build a bonfire and open a case of Coors and cook some meat on like two metal poles.
And we saw some
and
of those people.
Blast the winger.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Good morning, yeah.
One of those guys had a rifle.
Okay.
It was a shotgun.
I don't think it was a shotgun.
You don't think it was a shotgun?
He was hunting for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So there were shells on the ground.
We made sure to make sure that he knew we were there.
There you go. Oh, so somebody else was there.
Well, yeah, he was just walking by in the early morning. Like
packing heat.
Or packing, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Definitely. So
he was nice.
Oh, good.
He waved back.
Well, want that to be the case.
That's right.
As opposed to not waving back and like leveling the gun at you or something like that.
Yeah, I want to see the face of my killer. So
that's a good consideration.
And that's an interesting assumption too.
I'm assuming that's not an abstracted thought. That's connected to like the guy that's walking around and hunting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you want to know if it's like some prominent political figure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could have been Cheney.
Okay. Well, I wasn't going to say it, but yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's cool. No, it's on you. So, hey, Republican listeners.
Is that libel?
It's Aaron Delaney at...
let's talk about We Were Sons, because this is the project
we
Aaron
like
Green.
Sons. We yes. Were Like Sons.
Oh.
We Were Like Sons.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Let's start that
and,
over again.
And let's clarify. It's We Were Like Sons.
We Were Like Sons.
S-O-N? S-U-N?
S-O-N. Like
S-O-N.
Father.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Well, let's back this up just one more time.
Okay.
So, Aaron Green, let's talk about your new project, We Were Like Sons.
Great. Let's do it.
Thank you for indulging me. I just want to make sure people get it right. So this is a book that you've been working on.
Yeah.
And how long has this project been in the works?
Well, I've been writing the book for a number of years, probably 4 years on and off. But it wasn't until about the last year and a half that I got really serious about writing. And I moved up to Portland about 9 months ago. And moving up here was, in fact, to get more serious. So I was living in L.A. and working for a company down there and splitting my time kind of creatively, like writing in the mornings and then going to work and then kind of trying to finish after work. But I realized it just wasn't cutting it. So I decided to move here. And it was the greatest decision I've ever made because I have so much more time. And I love the environment is really good for writing. It's just such a wonderful city for that, especially
also
for young writers. Well, where we sit
at the IPRC
happens to be where I'm taking a creative writing course.
Yeah, you can mention this place.
Okay, that's, cool. That's cool. Totally I didn't cool. know.
Oh, yeah. You totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't have any stalkers yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's always a reading at a bar some night every week or a coffee shop or something like that. There's always an opportunity for, you know, little meetups to write with people. Everybody's seems to be all about it. So I wasn't able to find that in L.A. It was just hard.
Right.
It was just a really hard city to write in and to find a community of writers.
I was thinking it was interesting that you refer to Portland as being a more serious place than somewhere else. Because there's a lot of wacky shit going on there, in this town. But yeah. When you say that you came from L.A., then I think that kind of puts it in perspective.
Yeah.
Because I would say, not that L.A. is a terrible town or anything, but no. There's a lot of silliness happening there, too.
Yeah, yeah, and it's definitely got its focuses. But other than that, it seems really cut and dry.
Yeah.
That's been my experience. Now, Delaney lived in L.A. with me, actually, a long time ago. So yes. He's got his thoughts on that, I'm sure.
So much but. Crazy stuff happened there. Ridiculous F stories.
Right, right. And we're going to – I want to pick up you learning to ride, but we'll do that in your segment later on. But that all happened in L.A., as I recall.
Wait, what do you mean?
You learning to ride bikes or like becoming a bicycle rider. Not learning to ride for the first time. You had a story about – we'll tell it later.
Okay, yeah.
But yes, so Portland, L.A., different towns.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Yeah. And that's not to, I don't want to like sound like I'm knocking LA. I love LA and that's where my family's at. It's just that I knew that I needed to get serious about writing the book. And, I lived in Portland for a really short stint before and, really felt like it was a very creative environment that I wanted to go back to and try to finish my book. And so, yeah, so that's why I came up here and I spent probably the first 6 or 7 months pounding it out, basically writing every, trying to write every day and
doing my best.
Yeah. And, finally coming to a point where I was ready to say, I'm done. I'm ready to send this to an editor. So I have a friend who is a professional editor. She does freelance work. And so I sent it to her and she and I have been kind of corresponding the last 3 months, just back and forth. And she tore it apart in the best way possible.
I guess that's why you have an editor.
Exactly. Exactly. If I see Delaney has the first copy.
Okay. So you have the first edition.
We are on draft 5 now. So that it's just almost a different book, but it's for the better. It's really become something I'm truly proud of.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I think I was telling you this right before we started rolling tape, but the problem, the dearth in bicycling books and literature is
there is a dearth of
good writing. And we talk about, I think we talked about this with Brian Benson and we talked about it with Tom Allen when he was in town. And it's just like the difference between telling a story and creating a compelling narrative that teaches you something, not just about like the specific data points of riding a bicycle from one place to another, but like the human experience and what that does to you, how it shapes you, how it changes you and why people do it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of travelogue writing out there that doesn't get to that. And so I'm so glad you're doing this because there needs to be more. There needs to be more people talking about, hey, this is why this happens, not just like, how crazy is it? We went from coast to coast. So that being said, you went from coast to coast.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Rode from Huntington Beach, which is about 20 miles south of L.A. Mm-hmm. proper. And, you know, that's in Orange County, which is where I grew up. And we rode from that. We dipped our back tires in the Pacific Ocean.
You did it.
We did the
you
tire
totally
dip.
Did.
Yeah.
All right.
But I have a funny story about that.
Do tell.
Well, okay. So after we dipped our tires and we did our kind of commencing ceremonies and we took off. Well, when we got to New York, it wasn't until day 4 that we remembered, oh shit, we forgot to dip our front tires in the Atlantic.
Oh god.
So we were leaving the 5th day that we were there.
Yeah.
So we like got on a subway and went out to Coney Island and stood in the water like ankle deep and
we got to find some ocean.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly. And it's not exactly easy to do in New York City.
Right. So this trip, it's California to New York.
Yes.
And this was in 2008. Is that right?
2008.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a little ways behind us.
Yeah.
Almost 7 years ago.
Okay. Before it gets too far, we're going to talk about the project and what's happening with it and everything. But we should mention first and foremost, and one of the things people should know is that this is a Kickstarter project.
Yes, yes.
Because this is a project that needs to be published, and yet you yourself don't have the funds,
right,
the discretionary money to just do this as a passion project. So
you're
raising money.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're self-publishing.
I'm self-publishing.
You're not going to publishers. And
right. Yeah, yeah. I decided pretty early on, not because I have some vendetta against big publishing, the Big Five or whatever it is, but because this has always been sort of a personal milestone to finish my first book, and I loved writing the story, and so it seemed more intimate to do a shorter run. And you know, maybe in the future I will send the manuscript off, and that's down the road, and I don't really know what will happen.
Second edition.
Yeah, but for now, I'm basically acting as my own publisher, and I'm learning a lot about that. And it takes hiring an editing staff, as I've kind of mentioned, proofreaders, designers, video people. Like, I had a friend help me with my video who does videography, and Delaney here is helping me with the website because he's a really tech-savvy guy.
A web maven.
So there's a lot of there's just a lot of small things that you don't think about. Marketing and PR, that's been one of the huge things that I'm mostly doing.
Yeah, and that's on you, because that's usually, like, if you have a publisher, they have some sort
they
of publicity
have a whole staff
wing.
And they have connections and things like that, which is what I don't have. So it's being self-published. I decided to run a Kickstarter because I always thought that Kickstarter was sort of like the Google of fundraising, if you will.
Right.
So it's like you just sort of know the name.
Or the Kleenex of facial tissues.
That's right.
It's like it's the name recognition.
The name recognition, yeah.
Or the Band-Aids of Band-Aids.
Yeah, exactly. See, our point proven.
Yeah.
Wait, Band-Aid is a
brand name. Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, I figured more people would know about it that way. Plus, one of the things that I love about Kickstarter is that it sort of requires the community to come together to make something happen, which is different than other, you know, crowdfunding sources. That you might try to shoot for something, but if you don't make it, it's not that big of a deal because you still get some of it. Whereas in Kickstarter, like, the risk is really a lot higher. So I think people, and rightly so, feel a lot more a part of something when they get to help fund a project. I know that's how I felt when I've funded stuff on Kickstarter before, too.
Totally, yeah. So, you feel like, hey, I wanted this, and I helped bring it into reality.
Yeah.
As opposed to Maroon 5 when they hit the pop music market.
They wanted
the radio.
This and should not have brought it into reality.
Well, and I tried to find out, like, where. So Maroon 5 must have come from somewhere, right? And there was, like, nothing online. It was like they just emerged into the world as a perfectly formed band with a, you know, a hit record or whatever.
Yeah.
It disillusioned me. But
were they all Mouseketeers?
No. They were like an alt band before with a different sound, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So look it up. Check it out. I'm not going to put the link up for that one. That's on you if you want to find out.
We got some integrity here.
Yes. Use the search engine of your preferred method.
That's right.
Bing
that.
So you're... That's right.
No, Ask Jeeves, man.
Ask Jeeves.
Lycos.
Oh, man.
I was curious about you've got some rewards listed on your Kickstarter page.
Yes.
One, the one I signed up for. And the one, hang on, let me do this. The one you should sign up for, listeners, at the very least, is the $25 level, which gets you your own print paper copy, paperback book, We Were Like Sons. So go out and do that. Fund it today. But there are many levels of rewards offered on Kickstarter. And one of the things that stood out to me was that you can actually buy a tour with Aaron Green, bicycle tour.
Again? Yeah. For real?
Yes.
Yeah, so a long time ago, right after my friend Les. Les was the guy who went with me on my bike tour. He's one of my best friends. And right after that summer, the summer after that, we decided to create something that still sort of exists, kind of. Delaney's laughing because he knows what I'm going to say.
Okay.
It's called Tour Life. And it had this idea of, like we had come up with this philosophy that we called Tour Life. So after we got back from our tour across the country, we had so many friends who wanted to do it too. So we started calling it Tour Life, and we would take friends. And mostly we only did it two or three times because we would just sort of do it every summer. We did a trip from San Francisco down to LA. And these are with people who don't necessarily cycle.
Okay.
These are like people who are new to it and just wanted to jump in. And then we did one from right around Medford down to San Francisco, taking the coast both times.
So Southern Oregon down to the Bay Area.
Right. And so I've enjoyed that, and I love it. And you know, I've done obviously like little camping trips, weekend trips, or week long trips since then. But one of the things that Delaney and I were talking about back when I was talking about starting the Kickstarter and coming up with like tiers and stuff like that was offering tours, basically.
Sure.
And so, like, I was just sort of dreaming, like, throwing it out there. Like, of course, it started with, like, we could do a weekend trip or we could do a week-long trip. But then I was like, well, hell, let's do a whole summer.
Right.
Like,
why not?
If somebody did it, like, I'm totally game. So on the Kickstarter, there are actually four different tours. There's the day-long tour where we just sort of tour Portland. And the idea is that it's a big group.
Mm-hmm.
We'll kind of all just ride from place to place.
Because there's going to be like 50 people that choose this one.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a day-long thing. There's a weekend-long thing. There's a week-long. And then there's the six-week.
There we go.
That's the big daddy.
And so your tour that the book is based on in 2008, mm-hmm. was that a six-week tour or longer?
It was about six. It actually took us 40 days.
Okay.
So, and that was we were booking it because we had sort of a time deadline. My friend had a job he had to start at the end of the summer. So, yeah, we didn't waste a lot of time, which is my one. I'm not going to say I regret it, but it's the one thing I would change if I could go back and do it again.
Add a little more fluff time, just time to hang out, relax, and see places.
City. Yeah, because the first half of the trip, so from L.A. basically to Colorado, we were trying to hit 100 miles every day.
Okay.
And we were pretty new to cycling, too, so this was just absolutely destroying us. we joke that the first week of the tour was what got us in shape. Because I remember we did 7 or 8 days straight, and then we took a day off, and like my body was so tired. Like I remember eating every hour, just like hundreds of calories.
Yeah. So it's not the bicycling that'll kill you; it's the day off after.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah.
It's strange, and I don't know. Maybe people can relate with that, but I found it one of the strangest things. Like I felt more hungry on the days that I wasn't riding.
Yeah.
Than on the days that I was.
Because you don't have that physical activity to like distract you.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're kind of always eating a granola bar or something like as you're riding too. So that could be that part of that, but. Yeah, but then after that, we decided that we didn't really enjoy the fact that we were having to push ourselves so hard.
Like, okay.
We did have the time constraint, but we also knew that we weren't enjoying it. We started saying things like, all we do is eat, sleep, and ride. And that wasn't that fun.
And not like a point of pride, but just kind of like, we kind of wish there was more.
We wish there was more. Okay, like, we wish it didn't have to just come down to eating, sleeping, and riding.
Okay.
Because even the riding was more of a chore. So we wound up taking a bus, which is sort of, you know, that comes up in the book. And it actually worked out because Les was sick.
Okay.
So we wound up just getting on a bus, I think from Wichita to St. Louis or something like that, caught ourselves up. And then we only had to average like 80 miles or something.
There you
like
go.
That.
So then like if you wanted to have reasonable riding days, kind of that, some of that distance was taken off of the.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It was less stress to get somewhere by a certain time. We could sleep in a little bit if we wanted to, or we could enjoy like something at the end of the day's ride. And it just made all the difference.
Some respite. Yeah.
Yeah. I totally recommend like doing a century here and there is fun on a tour, but I wouldn't do that again every day.
Totally. Yeah. So. I was just going to say that the Kickstarter reward for the 6 week tour could possibly recreate the tour that you described.
That's
like
right.
If somebody really wants to do this, they could join you and
absolutely.
You would guide them through this experience.
I am all in.
Including the bus to where? To St. Louis?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Including the bus ride. Yeah, yeah.
Wichita to St. Louis.
We could even write another book based on it.
There we go.
Yeah.
We were also like sons.
We too were like sons. Yeah.
So, again, there's a Kickstarter. We're going to have a link to that on our website. You can also go to wewerelikesons.com.
If you go to wewerelikesons.com, it will right now it'll redirect to the Kickstarter page.
Okay.
So, actually, yeah, if you want to just type in wewerelikesons.com, and that's S-O-N-S again.
Right.
That'll take you straight to the Kickstarter.
We were not like flaming balls of gas.
Yeah.
I also just thought that you never hear a public radio host or a, you know, you never hear them end with an up inflection when they're saying like .com.
Oh yeah.
So that's what sets us apart.
Because we ask questions.
That's right. Hard-hitting journalism.
That's right.
Oh, so I don't want to spoil the book, and neither do you, but what can you tell us about the story that you're writing, and what can people expect?
Yeah, so here's something that I think makes the book a little different than maybe the traditional tour story. I decided to write essentially two different stories that run at the same time. So you've got the linear trip from LA to New York City, and that's sort of going all the while. You kind of hop in and out of that story. So the book starts out on the first day where we're doing the tire dip and we're doing the send-off ceremony and that sort of thing. From there, though, there's the second story that has more of a true like arc to it. In the sense of it sort of like building tension and problems and getting through things. And I will say this too, that story largely has to do with why we took the trip in the first place. So you have the second story that's going on and you're kind of learning both at the same time. And it's not till you get to New York that you find out, oh, here they go on the tour, basically. So you kind of come full circle.
So one of these stories is like a matte painting then in a film or something like that?
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just kind of there in the background to provide some context.
And the other thing I did is I wrote them in different tenses. So the first one is in a third person perspective, point of view. And the first one is written from my perspective.
Yeah.
So I talk about, which sounds weird. Like, so it was weird. It was weird to write Aaron and Les did this. That's not how I wrote it. But, you know, like it was weird to write that way. But interestingly, I was able to sort of distance myself and make that more of like a tour story between two friends.
Yeah. You get like the God view of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. The omniscient narrator is what they call it. And
well, that's got to feel good.
Yeah, in some ways.
That's good for the ego, right?
I kick him off a bike.
Yeah. A smite button.
Yeah.
But yes.
So, and then the second story, again, is sort of the backstory leading up to the trip, and that's written from my point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm assuming, obviously, generally when people write, they don't go from cover to cover, like beginning to end. But did you write all of the third person at once, all the first person at once? Did you bounce back and forth between the two?
I wrote the third person first.
Okay.
In fact, the earlier chapters, maybe I shouldn't say this. But, well, I'm going to say it. The earlier chapters I wrote several years ago.
And the earlier chapters are free, if I'm not mistaken.
They are. They are. They're free on AaronGreenStories.com. We should put those up on WeWereLikeSons.com.
I'll fix that tonight.
Delaney's my webmaster.
Webmaster on it.
Yeah.
It's 1999 and I'm a webmaster.
Or I thought you were a sysop.
Yeah.
You can find us on the fiction bike riding ring, the web ring.
The web ring. Gosh.
The alt list. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Catch me on IRC.
Angel Fire Pages. Am I right? Okay.
But the second part of the story, that all, like I was saying earlier, was written within, I would say, the last 6 to 9 months. And that a lot of that has to do with going through the class I'm taking here at the IPRC and having a cohort and everybody to kind of help me work through some of those pieces of the story and that sort of thing. So that's a product of that, actually.
Yeah, I would imagine it helps to have people around you.
Definitely. Definitely.
Kind of, yeah, you critique and edit your work.
Right, yeah.
I mean, this is a very personal story. Was that process ever, like, uncomfortable?
You know, it
who's the worst teacher? Spill the dirt.
You know, it wasn't uncomfortable because pretty early on we sort of, I think we established a pretty close-knit sort of vibe within the group.
Okay, and so people, it turned into a safe space.
People felt comfortable. Yeah, in fact, the mode by which we did those workshopping sessions were such that we looked at things a little bit more objectively and we never talked about somebody's name or whatever, you know, I wish John would have done this type thing. It was more like the author could have done this and the author kind of sits and writes and takes notes. It's really kind of a neat process, but definitely to the vulnerability aspect of the story, I would say like 2 years ago, it would have been really hard for me to share some of the things that are going to be in this book.
Yeah.
But
you're digging deep on content, as I understand.
Yeah. There are some things that lead up to the bike tour that are pretty personal things, but at the end, I feel like they're honest. Mm-hmm. I think honesty is the best story that I can write. And
we got the finger pistol from Delaney over there.
Delaney. You know, Delaney actually told me this was like last May. We were sitting at a bar and I was debating whether or not to even put the second story into the book. And this was sort of a pivotal moment. And I was like, man, well, I was feeling insecure about some of the things I was going to put in it because it's just a vulnerable thing. And Delaney, I think this is what you said almost verbatim. I think you said, well, okay, maybe I'm not going to say it verbatim. You said something like.
Now I really want to hear
it. Now I can't remember.
How many swears were peppered into this?
I said something along the lines of.
Yeah, what did you say?
You know what? You can give the details of how the tour went, but nobody gives a fuck about that shit.
Okay, that's not what you said. You said a good story is just a good story, basically. But you were drawing a huge difference between a good story and a great story, and a lot of that is the honesty, which I'm going for. I think that creates a very relational side of this book that people are able to relate with.
Yeah. So, well,
that's
again,
what I'm for.
Yeah, totally. That's the if you're reading about how someone did a tour and the technical details and everything, that's what you're saying, Delaney, is that it's like nobody really cares about, you know, like how many minutes it took to start the campfire.
Mm-hmm. Or
like, actually, I do care about that.
Okay.
I care about that because I'm very technical.
Right.
What he was trying to do was something else.
Okay.
Something
so totally different. The number of minutes for the campfire is less universally compelling.
Yeah.
Or something.
So. Universally compelling.
You disagree.
Totally.
No, it's just like, I like the idea that this, the reason that everybody goes out is to learn about themselves. And if you don't have that, then you're just reading about someone doing the Tour de France.
Right.
You know, and, you know, good luck if you're doing the Tour de France. It's great. It's not for me.
Yeah.
Not my thing. But the thing that is compelling to me about bicycle touring is that it puts you out in a position that is uncomfortable at times. And that you learn through the experience, whatever that lesson is, even if it's just like, I don't like climbing hills. I shouldn't have worn a cotton t-shirt or like any other number of things that you could learn on a bicycle tour that tie into things about your lifestyle, about who you are as a person. And you come out knowing more about yourself on the other side. So I like that idea. So that's a good reason to write a story.
Yeah. I totally agree. And that's what makes it compelling, too, when you retell the story, is you talk about these really human things that you experienced. Like, you can talk about how long it took you to start a fire, but I think that there are other things that, you know, like you're saying, that make a story more compelling or more relatable, rather.
Rather than talking about how long it took you to start a fire, talking about, because I've done this.
Oh, true. So, I didn't think about that.
The sort of ego blow you take when you can't start a fire. And,
yes, exactly.
And everybody's watching you and waiting to cook their food and all of that sort of internal psychological pressure you put on yourself.
Definitely.
I remember that time.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking about that when I used the fire analogy, but that's a good tie-in. Yeah. I'm also curious as far as writing this book. We just talked about how like the details aren't important, but I am curious about some of the details.
Sure.
As far as things that you did, what were the things that you most appreciated about what you brought? What could you have left behind
on the tour?
Yeah.
Oh, good question. So this is actually okay. Two of the things that I've learned, especially on that tour, that were of just critical importance, were a tarp and bungee cables.
Ah.
Man, like. Because we learned that you could make a bike tent with a tarp, like during the sun when you're in the desert. So you can create like sort of like temporary shade. Obviously, you can use it like a footprint under your tent and things like that. But on the rare, you know, time that it rains, you can wrap your stuff, all kinds of things. The tarp just, and then the bungee cables. We can't tell you how many times we would like go to a grocery store and like, oh crap, our bikes are already loaded super high.
Oh, right.
There's like nowhere to put your stuff, so you kind of like have to rig this like monstrosity and hope you don't tip over and drop all your food and stuff like that. So, but on the tour, sort of funny, I received a coffee press, like a little travel size coffee press.
While on the tour?
No. Right before I left. And I had it in my mind before we left that this was going to be this great, great American tale of, you know, just experiencing lots of things and drinking coffee and reading your books and journaling. And so I had like probably had like 5 novels, a coffee press, and like 2 pounds of coffee on me. And nuts, and on top of that, I had a bunch of like clothes that I found I never used.
Like, so I'm going to luxuriate in a flannel shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
And make coffee and read like half of Steinbeck and then keep on writing.
Precisely.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember losing a couple books on a bus at one point, and it was like I was all the better for it. But I got to Flagstaff and I looked at all of my luggage and I realized, A, I was only wearing like one other shirt because I was wearing like bike shirts.
Okay.
And then I had like a t-shirt. So I decided that I would just keep one t-shirt. And then when I wasn't needing to wear it, I would just wash it and let it dry as we rode. It would kind of like flap in the wind.
It's the best kind of dryer.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I sent back clothes, a coffee press, coffee, because I figured we could just pick up coffee. I don't know what else.
Yeah. No, it's cool. I'm curious. What clothes did you bring that you didn't wear? Like what did you anticipate wearing that you didn't?
Like a pair of jeans I sent back.
Okay.
And I put all this stuff in a box and just mailed it home.
So like going out of the town type stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I had an extra pair of shoes, jeans, a couple t-shirts, maybe a jacket too.
Okay.
These were all things that you no longer need when you basically live as a cyclist for 40 days.
Right.
You know, and you get into a rhythm and you just find like you just sort of change into your other shirt and that's all you do.
And that's the wardrobe change, right?
Yeah, I mean, unless your tour is one where you do have several days in between, but that's not what we had.
Right,
so
right.
I think from there I learned to be a lot more minimalistic in the way I like pack on tours now. It's almost one of those things where you can, the way I think about it now is that you can just sort of pick up things as you go.
And like if you need it, there's a store somewhere that sells
it. There's going to be something, yeah. Unless you're like somewhere really remote, which is not always the case with like road tour cycling.
Well, there are so few places that you are where you really need something, you can't get it. I mean like
– yeah.
Or like a substitute or a pinch hitter for something. You know, it's like
– exactly.
I don't know. You can make one thing do the job of another thing, or you can do without it for another, a day or two because you don't need it that badly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. You really get into like the temporary lifestyle mindset as you're touring, I think.
Yeah.
Like temporary in the sense of like, well, I just got to make this work until we get to the next place.
Like it might suck now, but it's not going to suck forever.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully not.
Go bicycle touring, everybody. But it does attract a certain kind of, I don't know, like not everybody knows what they're getting into when they set out on a tour, but there is, it's almost like a strange masochism of like, you know, this is going to hurt a little bit, but it's going to be good for you.
Definitely.
It's like a character building experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I wanted to touch on the title of the book itself, We Were Like Sons. And I believe is that – I didn't get there because I only read the first 2 chapters of the 5 free chapters available. Do you – you've disclosed the quote online, I think.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But the reason the book is called that?
It is called We Were Like Sons because as Les and I traveled across the country, we – met all kinds of people who took us in and treated us like their own. And I would say probably half the time we had couch surfers or warm showers hosts ready to set us up. But when we didn't, like if we were going to some remote town, which was half the time at least, we just had to roll up and start knocking on doors and see what happened. And usually it was we just wanted to camp in their yard.
Right.
You know, and I kid you not, like 9 times out of 10, like I think there was only 1 or 2 times that somebody said no, but like 25 times we stayed with somebody who was like, yeah, not only do I have a place for you for you guys to set up, but dinner's at 6, so we'll see you then.
Right.
There was this guy in Illinois, just like quick story, this guy in Illinois I was feeling defeated because it was my turn to knock on doors, and I was feeling super self-conscious.
You guys
about
trade
it.
Off on the responsibility.
We were trading off, okay. Yeah. And that was something that Les instituted because he's a lot more outgoing than me. He's like, Aaron, you need to do this. I was like,
so you'll thank me later for this.
Yeah. So like I went up to we're rural Illinois. Like there's if people are home, they're out in the field. Like they're farming. This is like farmland. And so a lot of people didn't answer their doors, and I was feeling pretty defeated. And we roll up to this other house. I think it was like every house was like a mile apart, basically. We roll up to this fourth house, and this guy kind of walks out, and he doesn't even like, here's two guys on bikes who are just sweaty and grimy and just all kinds of stuff hanging off their bikes at this point. And he sort of like looks at us and then just kind of keeps going about his business. Like he's seen that like all the time.
I know your kind.
Yeah, exactly. So I call out to him, and I'm like giving this really terrible version of the story. Like, hey, we're from California. We're touring New York. We're looking for a place to stay. And he goes, well, kind of like I was saying earlier, he's like, well, you're in luck because I have the best place for touring cyclists.
Ooh.
Follow me. So he gets on his four-wheeler, and he just starts like – he just pulls the throttle back and starts going. And Les and I were just like, okay, we're riding through his backyard, through his grass. Like we go out into the pasture, and we're riding over these like corn fields where he's kind of like plowed a road through them.
Yeah, like rolling hills.
Yeah, rolling hills, right? So we're going up and over, and then we see him kind of in the distance, like turned and like looking for us.
Where the fuck are they?
Exactly. So we roll up, and I see he's like – he's set before what appears, and they're not redwoods, but what appears to be like a small forest.
Ooh.
And he's like, here you go. And I look out, and there's a lake with like a dock and boat, like little paddle boats. And he's like, you can stay here as long as you want. And, you can go swimming. You can kind of camp wherever you want inside the forest. And if, he was another one of the people who said, and dinner's at 6.
There you go.
See you then. So, We Were Like Sons, the title, getting back to that really quick.
Yeah.
We're leaving a host house in Colorado Springs, and Les looks over at me. We're riding down this hot kind of desert road, and he looks over and he says, Aaron, we were like sons to those people. And that just like, it like clicked. And that's never been something I've been able to let go. I even thought about like titling it something different, but I couldn't, that title just didn't leave ever. It felt like ordained in a way or something like that. It was like, and it just made sense. And that was our experience.
Like this means something.
We were the sons of all kinds of strangers across the country. And we were never met with hostility, never met with like, just people who were like, what do you mean? Like, it wasn't until like we got to like the coast again.
Yeah.
You kind of see that, which I think is kind of makes sense sometimes. Coast. Closer to the coast you get, sometimes people are different.
Yeah, well, and the bigger the cities are, I think the more people are kind of turned inwards and not necessarily prepared to give hospitality. And not all, sometimes for good reason. Like some people have been burned. Some people were good people, and then they stopped being good people because they got hurt or something.
Yeah.
But that
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I think there's something about learning to ask for hospitality.
Definitely.
And learning to like express your need. I think you don't really know how to be truly generous until you've had to ask for it.
Yes.
And that's a learning experience. If I've learned anything from going out and traveling by bike, it's that's a very useful thing because you realize what it feels like to be in the position of asking or the position of needing.
Right.
And how desperate you can feel or how depressed or dejected you can feel if you haven't had any luck getting what you need yet.
Yeah.
And I think if you're a good person, you're going to become a more compassionate person once you've had the experience of asking.
So, I would agree. Yeah, I think those one begets the other.
Yeah,
definitely.
And then of course you're in the you're in line to pay it forward. So next time you see somebody that needs something, you can help them out with kind of an inkling of what they're going through.
Yeah, definitely. And you can sign up very easily on Warm Showers or
that is
surfing.
True. Go out and do that today. If you've never hosted somebody, you don't have to do it 100 times. Do it once. It's going to be great. Warmshowers.org, couchsurfing.org. Both of these are fantastic ways to find people who need a place to stay. So, Well, thank you so much for telling us about this. Anything else we didn't touch on that you want to cover?
I think that's everything.
Okay.
I think yeah, the Kickstarter runs until the end of March.
There we go. So March 31st.
Yeah, yeah.
Get your bids in by then.
Yeah. March 30th, actually.
March 30th.
March 30th, everything ends.
March 31st, you breathe a big sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Publish your book.
I will be breathing a big... Well, unless it doesn't fund, then I will be locking myself in my room for a little while.
Okay. Give us your number.
Yeah. No, there's plenty of really cool things, including the bike tours. I mean, we're doing hardcovers, we're doing paperbacks, we're doing all kinds of little things like posters and stickers, and I think we'll do spoke cards too.
Oh, nice. So. We like spoke cards.
Yeah.
I love spoke cards.
Matter of fact, if we get our hands on some of those, we might send some out to some listeners.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Absolutely.
We'll find a way to contest for those.
I love the sound spoke cards make.
Like, yeah.
You get up to a certain speed or you get a crosswind.
Kind of a...
Yeah. It's pretty neat.
Yeah. And it's better than like the cards in the spokes.
The playing.
No,
I don't like that.
I don't prefer that. No. So it was wewerelikesons.com. Okay, great.
That's right.
Let's do some headlines.
Do this.
All right, here it comes.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. It circles around the city lights.
Pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast as we can into the day.
All right, this first one is real quick. Special shout out to Glenn Kubish.
Oh, yeah.
From bikeportland.org or via bikeportland.org from BBC News Toronto. Canadian freezeway could let residents skate to work.
This sounds so awesome.
Cold temperatures persist over much of North America this week, but rather than just trying to survive the winter, one Canadian city is trying to turn it into an asset. Unlike other cities in the U.S. and Canada that have banned activities such as tobogganing because of insurance costs, Edmonton has no such laws.
That's bullshit. Who bans tobogganing?
I don't know. There's a link out there, so you can go figure that out.
I'm okay. Yeah.
This isn't The Onion, right?
This is real. This is BBC real. Toronto. I think they ban tobogganing like as a form of transportation in the street, but it is still bullshit.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Yeah, no, this is a whole other news article here. It says, according to research by Nationwide Children's Hospital at Ohio State University, each year from 1997 to 2007, more than 20,000 children under the age of 17 required emergency room trips after sledging accidents.
Oh my God. Wait, so they're banning tobogganing as a whole?
Wow.
Let's see here. In municipal offices, places like Idaho... Well, all we know is that there are places where it's illegal to toboggan, and that just seems wrong.
That's some old bullshit
that
right
is,
there.
That is,
I'm
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Seriously.
And you can tell I'm pissed because the U turns into an O.
That is some bullshit.
That is some bullshit
yeah.
right there.
You want to, what I give that?
Hells
that,
yeah.
That gets gonged out. Okay.
All right. But anyways... Congratulations, Edmonton.
That's a great idea.
Once again, being such a great winter city.
The question is, will they permit hockey to be played on the freezeway? Because people could play basketball on cul-de-sacs, right? That's like a public street or
whatever. That's true.
And sometimes I have to ride through like somebody's like game of one-on-one or something.
Yeah. However.
But that's a puck.
Hockey's pretty serious.
Yeah, well, it's true.
And
basketball is not serious.
No.
I say in Rim City.
Not as serious.
But like the point of this is they're using skating as a form of transportation now.
Damn straight.
They're intentionally freezing their streets.
This is beautiful.
To skate on.
This is beautiful.
That is actually an interesting idea.
Yeah.
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 Can you take your bike on it?
Probably it's ice. I mean, I guess it would be at your own risk. You would have to maybe get studded tires.
Yeah.
I want to get a set of tires with like a circular blade on the tire and just like carve my way down this freezeway.
And just be like, it'd be a set of like maybe grinders of some kind, like files on your tires and then a cup behind it. And then you can sell slushies.
Oh, there you go.
Rear tire has traction. Front tire is blade.
That's not a bad idea. The problem with the slushy is that it comes out looking like Coca-Cola already.
And why is some of it brown?
Because it's a city street.
Yeah.
and yellow.
This one's lemon flavored. This one's Coca-Cola flavored.
Your two options.
That's a great marketing.
That's all you got. Which
is perfect.
What's next?
Next up, these next two will be in conjunction with each other, both from bikeportland.org. First up, Oregon lawmaker wants to punish people who bike without reflective clothing.
Jung, jung.
Have you guys heard of this yet?
I
have not.
Oh, this is also some old bullshit right here.
There we go. Representative special edition of news.
Oh.
Yeah, it is. Some old bullshit news. Representative John Davis, by the way, they included a link to his website there, introduced House Bill number 3255. Also, will be linked, so you can read the whole thing. According to the text of the bill, Davis wants anyone caught riding a bicycle on a highway or on premises open to the public without wearing reflective clothing to be punished by a maximum fine of $250. The bill also dictates that clothing is, quote, including but not limited to a reflective coat or reflective vest. The new law would only apply to people riding bicycles at night between sunset and sunrise. The new offense, failure of a bicycle operator to wear reflective clothing, would be a Class D traffic violation.
What? So even during the summer, you have to wear a coat or
you can't even wear glitter.
Hold on. Before we go on, I just want to also introduce the next headline.
Okay.
And I didn't include any body of this because I want to encourage anybody who's listening to just go and read this, because these are some really good thoughts that Jonathan Miles had and still has. Thoughts on lawmakers who, quote, just want to start a conversation.
Unquote.
And it was an article he wrote in January 2011 and then revisited, reposted, and then also updated as it pertains to this latest fun stuff from Representative John Davis.
Yeah, Davis is a load of fun. That guy. He's all about fun.
And other F words.
Seriously. I'd like to throw a few F words at him.
But he's got a really good point of like, are you really... I mean, the sort of subtext of this is like, are you really just trying to start a conversation? Because there are way better ways to start a conversation, and here they are.
Like, hey, what do you think about bicycle safety?
Right, exactly. Or
like, you can't do this.
I'm concerned about bicycle safety. Let's throw some money at the DOT so they can start a study to see what the viability of, you know, a proposed bill or what the impact of a bill in my head might be, rather than just proposing the bill and, you know, all controversy.
Like tossing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks.
And seeing what sticks. Yeah. So anyways.
I'm curious if, we know from the World Naked Bike Ride that at least in that event, nudity is considered to be free speech and protected by the Constitution.
Yes.
So if I were to wear a reflective vest and nothing but a reflective vest,
would I pass muster
for him?
I would think that would be a great protest.
Okay, so we need a World Naked Bike Ride except for...
Hey, kids. Do you not like Bill 3255? If you don't like Bill 3255, you should ride naked in the streets with just reflective clothing.
There we go. Sounds like a plan.
You said, hey, kids.
Hey, kids. And then naked.
Well, yeah, we're using that kind of in the, you know, the jocular term,
sure,
terminology.
Yes,
we're joking around.
Hello, adults.
This is all for
hello,
satirical
purposes. Hello, consensual adults.
Yes,
there,
indeed.
There, you can superimpose my voice
right
over top.
I'll fix it in post. All right, then. Well, that's fascinating. I don't really know what else to say.
There's been a rash of those. There was earlier this year some dude talking about how, once again, we got to license our bicycles.
Oh, to start a conversation.
Because yeah. I want to start a conversation about bike safety.
Right, right.
Bullshit.
Either of you, Aarons, have any other thoughts on that?
I actually wouldn't mind owning a license to legitimize my bike riding abilities.
Oh, right. Like,
yeah.
So like when you're riding in the lane and somebody honks at you from a combustion engine vehicle,
yeah,
you pulled out your license. You're just like, check it out.
Fuck off, you bastard.
That's right.
I'm supposed to be riding here. Share the road, you motherfucker.
Exactly. That's what it actually, that's what it would say on the license.
Yeah. I changed my name.
Yeah.
I changed my name, yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, that I, yeah. that's not a bad idea. Like, that's how I feel often when somebody honks at me. When
but,
I'm,
okay, but there is, you already have a license.
Sure,
that
yeah,
legitimizes,
there are laws. That's right.
It's called,
right.
It's called Oregon law. It's state law. You're allowed the lane.
Right.
You know, and that's my big thing about the licensing, about wearing reflective clothing, is the fact that there are too many drivers out there who drive as if the laws protecting bicycles don't apply to them.
And that's some bullshit.
And that's some old bullshit
yeah.
right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again.
Oh, man.
All right.
I got to play devil's advocate here, though, too.
Ooh. Advocate for the devil, sir.
Yeah, because today I... Woo-hoo. Oh, my gosh. Okay, confession time.
Yes!
it's so, just got super religious.
Yeah, confession time. So, Father. No. So here's what happened. So this afternoon, I was like, I'm going to go try some good coffee around where I work. So I get on my bike and I find this coffee shop nearby and I start riding my bike and I'm like, cool, wow, what an empty street. And I'm like, wait, why is that BMW like coming straight at me?
Ooh, good
as
question.
Though, yeah. As
though he had the right to do so.
Playing chicken.
Were you right? Going the wrong way on a one-way street?
And so I just kept going because I don't have a panic button. I have no panic button. I'm like, somebody's gonna have to move, you know? And it's not me. Right? And this car's approaching me. I'm approaching this car. And the look on the woman's face is like, what are you doing? And I go, what am I doing?
And what was the answer to that question?
So I was riding the wrong way on a one-way street.
How did you know when that was the case?
When she made that facial expression, like,
oh, okay.
What are you doing? I am so above the law.
And,
crazy.
And you're not above the law. I mean, yeah, that is kind of on you.
It was totally on me. That's such an asshole.
Well, don't beat yourself up.
But in the same way, like, I mean, I don't know. It adds a little bit more weight, you being on a bicycle, because you're kind of more under the microscope, I think, just as a bike rider. And that's just the sad fact of nature. But, I mean, in the same way, a car riding the wrong way on a one-way street, you know, that's also illegal.
That's right.
Yeah, we're way more vulnerable on bikes, so.
Yes. Yeah. Well, however, biking is not dangerous. It's the speed of the car crashing into the bike.
It is.
And the driver survives because they're encased in a bunch of steel and glass. The bicyclist doesn't necessarily survive because they have zero protection.
Yeah.
Even if they wear a helmet.
Yeah.
And I don't know. So I'm going off. I'm on my soapbox here. But honestly, like, it's not about reflective clothing. It's not about having a license. It's honestly about cops needing to enforce the actual laws that are already in place protecting the cyclists.
Yes,
that's
on the
right.
Road.
Yeah, and because part of the reason is that people don't actually know that there are laws. Like, a bike has the same rights that a car has to be in any street, bike lane or not.
Yes.
So, like, you know, you're going down Division. The bike actually has much right. Actually, I saw you going down Division today.
I was jogging
today, and I saw you coming. You're bombing down.
That's his favorite thing to do.
Which is great. And I had a friend who did that too, that I used to work with at a bike shop. And I told him about Clinton Street because he lived kind of in the same area as me, and he didn't even know about it. But he's like,
Clinton Street?
About Clinton Street,
really?
And how it's sort of a bike.
That it was there, and it was
street.
A safe place to ride.
That it was safe,
ostensibly.
Yeah. And I showed it to him one day, but he was like, you know, I don't know. Division is just faster. It's just faster to me. Which is like, that's the mindset that I think you should be able to have.
Sure.
When it comes to...
Well, you
to,
should be able to take the option, I think.
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm not saying like you have to do one thing or the other.
Right.
But, you know, the reality is that if you're in a car and you don't ride a bike or you don't understand bicycling culture or anything, you're going to see a bicyclist in the middle of the road and you're going to think, what the hell is this guy doing in the road?
Right.
And not knowing that... Bikes are actually allowed to be there.
Unless you're riding behind Mr. Flores in the wintertime, in which case he has that patch with the legal
yeah,
code
it's actually,
number.
It's glued to my satchel, so I can't put it on my vest anymore. But I'm going to get me another one eventually.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe just to wrap that discussion up, I saw a tweet from Carl Larson of Bicycle Transportation Alliance fame and also of Bike Fun, who he said, basically, I'd rather take Division because there's more spots to stop for food.
Yes.
So
if I'm going to have to fight cars on either street, I'm just going to take Division.
Yeah.
So it was basically the gist of his.
I like this idea. Well, hey, let's take a little break in this doubleheader.
Right on.
We'll come back in a moment with Mail and Mr. Aaron Delaney and the other two Aarons and me.
A plethora of Aarons. Open Roads Broadcasting.